Borderline Podcast to Yokoso.
As Jeremy just said in Japanese, welcome to episode 21 of
Bad
Zipline.
Japanese. Yeah,
the official Zipper Interactive Podcast. I'm Chris Roper.
I'm Jeremy Dunham. You've already heard from me. Today we are joined by creative director Ed Byrne. Hi, Ed.
Hey, how's it going, guys?
Welcome back.
Good.
Thanks, yeah.
Good.
It's a nicer outfit you have here now.
Thank you. Yeah.
The hot tub in the corner and mm-hmm. the
It's not a time machine.
No. What's that pole for?
You'll find out after we're off the air.
Festivus.
You remember Ed was here on episode 5. That was many, many episodes ago. 16, if you're doing the math.
Something like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's sort of like...
That's fortuitous. Designers love power of 2. Mm-hmm. 8 and 16.
Well, 22. This is episode 21, though. There's no power of 2 applies to that.
Yes, was you right.
However, officially now, our podcast is old enough to drink.
Yes, that's true.
So, congratulations, podcast.
Zipline. Let's get into the Z-Cap here. First off, as a quick note, I'll just say that the Japanese intro care of Jeremy was there because TGS is going on right now. So SOCOM 4 is on display at TGS. You might see, you know, a little bit of news here and there. It's basically a re-audioed version of our Gamescom demo, though, so with Japanese voices and all that kind of stuff. So nothing crazy for you guys to see out there to listen to the show, probably, but it is there in case you're in Japan.
Thanks. Of course, the biggest news this week is that Mag 2.0 is coming out. Yay. It has a lot of the features that our current Mag beta has, so I'm sure you guys have seen a lot of those. The PlayStation Move support, the increased level cap, it goes to level 70. We have a revamped skill tree, the in-game economy system, clan deploy feature, and the Mag news page. All of that stuff will make it into 2.0 when you see it. And then, of course, we've got the updates in there that fix bugs, and we also have some map changes and some weapon updates, all sorts of cool stuff. One thing to note, the escalation maps that you see in the beta right now will not be a part of that, nor will the 9 new weapons, and that's because that's part of a DLC pack that we'll have information on further down the road.
Right. Now, speaking of Mag, we also put up our latest Influence Mag question. Influence Mag, for those of you who aren't familiar with it, is the thing where we ask you something saying, would you like this or this? And then you get to vote on what it is, and if there's enough votes, we'll change the game. So we've had... changing domination time limit and if disconnects counted as a loss. Our third thing is asking you we expect to have a very heated, discussions and whatnot about is whether you think the domination should become faction neutral or not. A lot of people say faction neutral is great. Some people are saying, you know, Shadow War considerations, all that. So we let you vote this time. Should domination become faction neutral or not? Go to the official Mag blog at blog.mag.com and you can vote on what you want to have happen there.
And actually, I think this is a good topic that that matches well with what we were talking about last week with Jason and Ben, where, you know, one of the topics of discussion was why don't we see more maps of existing game modes that often, and that was because of faction neutrality. If you introduce one new map, you'd have to introduce three in the case of whether or not something is specifically geared towards a faction or whether it's neutral, so... That's another thing to take into consideration when you guys make your decision.
Right, and you can try out the faction-neutral version of Domination in the beta right now. So go try it out before you decide
That's
to
right.
vote.
Try before you... Well, you've already bought it. So try before you alter the buy.
Yeah.
Right. One other bit of news, and this relates directly to this podcast. We alluded to it last week. But Zipline is actually moving to a bi-weekly schedule following this episode.
Give or take bi-weekly.
Yes. So with SOCOM 4, it's still many, many, many months away in 2011, and since most of our upcoming plans for Mag are already out in the open, we're scaling back how often we do the podcast a little bit. We may come back for special week-to-week episodes. Depends on the circumstances.
Right. As we get closer to SOCOM 4's launch, we'll bump it up to weekly again, or if there's a big announcement in the middle of week, maybe we'll do a special episode that comes up on a Tuesday or something.
But as it stands now, we're now a bi-weekly podcast. As of this episode, so our next one won't be until October the 1st, and that is when we'll have our special guest, our Zipper Vice President, Mike Gutman, who Ed has a meeting with later today. It was good working with you, Ed. And
we also have meetings with him.
We
so
do, actually, right?
Nice working
either
with
right
everyone.
Before or right after Ed's meeting.
Yeah.
Maybe it's to talk about this podcast. And our Q&A thread will be available next Monday as normal, even though the podcast won't go up next Monday. just so you guys have some advanced time to start asking your questions.
Right. Now, what I thought that we'd do is, because we talked last week, how we're not going to really talk too much about SOCOM 4 for a little while, at least in terms of new information. So I figured having you on the show would be a great time to talk about, you know, the development process of the game. I know we've touched on that a bit with a handful of people, but you being the creative director here at Zipper, can you talk about kind of the early days of SOCOM 4, some of where along the lines the story was written, when did artists start jumping in creating content, kind of how did that the first snowball get started rolling down the hill?
Yeah, well, let's see. So, you know, we'd come off of SOCOM CA and Fireteam Bravo 2, and I think that, you know, there was a period of sitting back, and the PS3 was out or was coming out, and, you know, we were really looking at the console and trying to work out, you know, where have we been? Where do we want to go? What are the things that we haven't been able to do because of technology, or the things that we haven't been able to do because of where the franchise was? So it started off, I think, you know, MAG was in full swing, and we started with a small team of just me and a couple other guys, and we looked at lots of different possibilities. We knew we had the MAG engine, so we were thinking, well, maybe we could do big open spaces, you know? Or, you know, we could maybe get some features in, like crowd dynamics. Maybe we have more focus on some of the special operations stuff that our consultants talked to us about, which included trailing people, setting up surveillance, urban operations, that kind of thing. So we had a bunch of ideas in hand. I built a big mind map, and, you know, we pasted all that in there. And then we got together with our Sony guys, and we sort of began to develop a strategic vision of, it was a combination of where Sony wanted to take the franchise and where they thought that the biggest sort of point of entry, the best point of entry would be. And then there was things, obviously, Zipper, that we had wanted to do and didn't want to do. I mean, we'd already done vehicles on SOCOM 3 and CA, and, you know, those are hit or miss, I think. And so we decided, let's go back to what we really know how to do, which is infantry combat, special forces, small team stuff, being deployed behind enemy lines and dealing with sort of smaller groups of enemies. But let's also make sure that we can put things in there that we'd never managed to do fully to our expectations or to our own desires, which is like story, better character development, more set pieces, you know, not boss battles per se, but, you know, some really memorable encounters with maybe some more unique elements to them. So long story short, you know, you start off with a bunch of ideas, you whittle them down. As we brought people on board, as we brought artists and more designers on board, and as our Sony producers worked with us, we began to crystallize that effort into something that, you know, sort of resembles SOCOM 4, not really. Case in point, let's see. I think we started off by having like a team of like 8 guys, maybe more. And we had these huge, you know, open battlefields, and it was much more procedural and dynamic. And there was no main character at the beginning of SOCOM 4. You just play this nameless ops commander, and you chose what time of day you wanted to deploy your forces in the field and that sort of thing. As we saw Uncharted come out, and as we saw the progression of modern military games go from tactical shooters like Rainbow Six into more story-driven things like, you know, Modern Warfare or Medal of Honor series. So we started to give the ops commander kind of a personality. We started to individualize all the guys in your team, reduce the size of the team so we could have more meaningful conflict and meaningful interactions between them. And then set up a much more elaborate, complex story with you know, some villains with some meat behind them and some perspective and some ambition. Not just the bad guy who's like, "Rah, I'm going to take over North Africa because I can." But more, you know, guys like, "Well, you know, actually, you're a bad guy and you're doing terrible things. But in some ways, I can sympathize with you. You know, maybe if I was, you know, on the other side of the fence, I would be on your side."
Can you talk about the writing process for SOCOM 4 a little bit? I mean, you've definitely, once you established the direction you wanted to go, how was the whole process of actually crafting the story that you've come up with for the game?
You got to do it with more than one person. So, you know, if you look at TV, if you look at film, you know, no one person sits down and writes a script and bangs out a screenplay and then goes like, bam, we're done. So it was a collaborative effort from the very beginning. Games are weird because, you know, we don't necessarily break our games into scenes. We don't break our games into chapters even. Our games are broken up into levels. So it was kind of like a parallel effort. We were designing, well, you know, what kind of levels do we want? I mean, do we want like a resort level? Because some kind of abandoned resort that got cut from the game. But it was pretty cool. you know, we want to a level where you have to go in and take out like a huge piece of military hardware, right? We want a level where that's set in this sort of mountainside fortress with ruins. So that wasn't really part of the story. Those are set pieces, and those are experiences we want the player to have. And then we have to tie in the story to that. So on one side, we're kind of building these cool locations and set up for cool encounters and gameplay. On the other side, we're trying to make a story that, you know, actually makes sense from start to finish, has some resolution, follows the strictures for good story, that kind of thing. We flew out and we went to like Rob McKee's story seminar, and we kind of, you know, we really drilled down. We tried to understand, you know, what makes a good story, which I think was pretty useful. And then once we had our levels in place, we had the entire campaign from start to finish. We kind of knew what the player was going to do. We had basic motivations. We had the encounters with the, you know, with the enemies and the bad guys and the somewhat bad guys, that sort of thing. Then we went back and we kind of filled out that structure with story. We, you know, we wrote the dialogue and we did our twists and turns and we did our, you know, epic events and we did our betrayals and we did all that kind of stuff. So that was written, I think it took about 6 months to a year to take a story and then completely like stomp the crap out of it. And then what emerged was the actual story. Because story is a process of deconstruction, right? You build something, you say, this is awesome. And then you read through it and you're like, oh, this sucks. And then you kind of like, you know, replace parts. And then at the end of it, it's like, you know, $6 million man, you can rebuild it. And it comes out and it's like this bionic robot. Actually, that's a pretty bad metaphor, but, you know,
it's the same one I was thinking. Just not that.
The process is like everything in games is iterative. You get a bunch of people together, creative people. You work on making the best product possible. And then after a year, you know, we had a story we really liked. We had characters we liked. And then we wrote that out as a screenplay, and then we took it down to mocap stage and filmed all the stuff and did all the dialogue and all that cool stuff.
Did we call Lee Majors?
Yeah, I think he was busy making hearing aid commercials.
You mentioned that there's kind of like the dual thing where you're planning, you're kind of writing these cool things in the story, but you're also kind of figuring out what the game, I guess, can be to what you can play, and you're kind of trying to fit these two things together. And I have to imagine that, because you've been in the industry for a little while here, but as time goes on, it seems like games can focus more on the story stuff and the ideas of you know, what is the experience going to be, rather than starting with the core mechanics, because there's so much more that you can do now that machines are getting more and more powerful, that it's kind of swaying more towards the filmmaking style, where you write the script and then you go, CG guys, I know we can make all of this, so I'm not worried about, you know, where it's going to go yet, and we'll figure out budget later.
Yeah, you see, in movies you edit, right? So you write the script, and that becomes kind of the Bible for production, right? Like, you know, when the script's locked, and, you know, everything is derived from that, right? Like, you know, you very rarely build a set, and then the director's filming, and he's like, you know what, this set sucks, you know? Let's move this scene to Turkey, you know? And everyone's like, but it's the North Pole. He's like, nah, the North Pole's not working. You know, you just don't do that, because the cost would be immeasurable, right? But in games, we can do that. We can be like, oh, let's add snow. Okay, boing. You know, it's not that simple, but it's pretty simple to change things around. So in games, the editing process happens all the time. In movies, it happens at the very end. You shoot a bunch of sequences, right? And then hopefully you get a good editor to take all the stuff you've shot and kind of cut it up. And the story tends to happen at the end as much as it does at the beginning, but it doesn't, you know, it's not iterative. But in games, we're constantly evolving. And so even if we have a really great story at the beginning, amongst game developers, it's really hard to get us to stick to that, because we'll be, you know, we're making the game, we'll be playing, and be like, oh, you know what? Yeah, you know what? There should be a submarine in here. And it should, like, shoot missiles at you. And then we put that in there because that's fun. Even though it changes the story, it's a game, right? So story is always going to be second in game. I hate to say it, but, you know, fun first. You know, we're always basically looking at what the best experience is for the player. And story is part of that, but gameplay is a bigger part of that.
Do you think that constant editing, though, could be construed as a negative, I guess? Because as any artist out there knows, plays music, does paintings or whatever, you're never going to be happy with what you're creating. There's always something else to do. So if you're constantly editing while something is not even really close to finished, you know, I mean, we don't show people a game after it's been in development for 6 months because it looks so different from what it'll be at the end.
Yeah.
That, you know, do you think that editing at that point, it is better, or would it hurt the experience of saying, I came up with this original idea and I'm going to sit back and let it go for 3 years. And at the end, hopefully it's going to come together as my original vision was, and I'm not going to tinker with it.
Right. Well, I mean, you know, it's good or bad. I mean, even if you edit at the end, like, you know, I'm not going to name names, but the last Star Wars movies, right, in particular are...
So those are some pretty specific names.
I said no names. You know, if the story sucks, and it's hard to edit something together at the end, you can save a movie with a good editor, you know.
If you have the high ground.
If you have the high ground. But, you know, it takes just as much discipline in games, right? So, yeah, I mean, you know, we've all played games where they've tweaked and tweaked and tweaked it to death, right? And I think sometimes that comes out as a bunch of good ideas out of order, or some good ideas mixed in with some really bad ones, or a game that just sort of seems confused, right? But, you know, art takes discipline, and it takes discipline to know when you're done. It takes discipline to leave it alone. And it takes trust amongst, you know, ourselves as developers to say, all right, this is good, you know? I think that part of design is knowing when you're done. You know, part of design is knowing when you've iterated enough and you have to go into production. I think if you give a designer like 100 years and an unlimited budget, you know, he won't stop after $20,000 and say, you know, I'm done. He's going to keep going. So partly that, you know, that's my job to say, you know, let's move on. Or partly it's my job to say, this feature is great, but we have to cut it to preserve these other features, right? So we have a kind of a hierarchy in place that keeps that discipline fairly strict and stops us from just kind of, you know, tweaking and that sort of thing. We prioritize the changes we need to make.
One thing that actually might be beneficial for people is we've had, this is your second appearance on the show. We've also had Seth on the show twice. Mm-hmm. And we've had Alan Van Slyke, who's our director of production on. So that's a game director and Seth. You're the creative director and Alan is the production director. Can you go over very briefly the differences between those director roles? We also have another director, Jason Tartaglia, who's our director of technology.
Yes.
Well, and I guess also down to Travis. Travis Steiner's been on the show twice now, and he's the lead design.
Yes.
So who does what in all those things, and when do the reins ever fully get passed from one job to another, or is it kind of always ebb and flow type thing as development goes on?
Yeah, it is. You know, I mean, games, as an industry in games, we have very little in the way of, we're like the anti-Hollywood, right? Like every studio, every team has a different way of doing things. The role description of creative director or lead designer can be completely different from one product to the next. For us, yeah, each of those director roles is having someone in place who can make a final call on something, you know? I mean, it's like a movie director, you know? You're not in the trenches, you're not like behind the camera. Yeah, you're not running the clapper. You're not, you know, pushing like a rig around or decorating the set.
Wait, I don't have to do that?
No, you don't.
All right.
Oh, damn, did I? Oh,
all right,
sorry.
See you later.
It's good to know.
You know, the point is you need someone at a high level to kind of keep an oversight who is sort of entrusting all the people below him or her to do everything right and who's there when a decision needs to be made that no one seems to be able to make or there's no consensus. Or sometimes when at a high level, it's like painting, right? You know, you paint a painting, and then if you're really up close to that painting and you don't step back and take a look at it, and sometimes your perspective is going to be skewed or your colors are going to be off or the composition is going to be whack. You just got to step back and you got to look at the big picture. And, you know, sometimes a director, so like Seth will do that, you know, in terms of the quality of the game or, you know, he comes from Sony with a perspective of, you know, what Sony's looking for, the strategic market of the game in terms of making SOCOM 4 or MAG, say, fit specific requirements, what they think a successful title will be. I tend to be involved pretty heavily at the beginning when the game or the IP or whatever is being developed and we're running story and characters and gameplay and environments and we need someone with a vision for how everything's going to work and tie together. And then I'll often, you know, keep writing and doing edits and working with the cinematic group and working with the design group all the way through. But it's Travis's job day to day to be like, here's the rules, here's the systems, the controls are this, you know, the multiplayer is going to work like this. The day-to-day sort of trench decisions are made by the leads. So the directors are kind of like, you know, if everything's going well, the director is sometimes maybe twiddling their thumbs, which is the hardest thing to do when you're a creative type, right? Is to sit there and be like, well, I guess everything's okay. No one's called me, so I guess everything's working. But that's the way it goes. You know, if a director is jumping in and saying, like, you do this, you do that, then quickly things are going to turn into chaos. Everyone has to have a strict understanding of, you know, who does what and where do my orders come from, right?
So you mentioned on your first podcast appearance that you wrote a book about game design. For people who may not have read it or like things in small summaries, what are some things that aspiring designers should remember when they start making their own games? I think that's a question that probably comes up more than any other that I've seen when people want to break into the game industry. And are there any common threads between the games that you've worked on or enjoy playing?
Wow, yeah. I mean, you know, I've talked with a lot of students and, you know, people GDC and whatnot. And you know, that is a pretty common thing is, you know, game design is funny, right? Like it's not funny, haha. It's funny, like an amorphous kind of scary thing that you quite know where it came from or where it's going or what it's composed of.
I'm working on it. I'll get an elliptical.
Sorry, man. I don't want to say anything. But there's no real definition of what game design is because, again, like I said, you know, everywhere you go, designers do different things. And sometimes game designers are more like programmers. They do scripting, set up encounters. Sometimes they just write design documents. Sometimes they write scripts, like screenplays. So the best thing for me that I found is because there are no strict requirements, because there's no strict role description, is be curious. Be curious all the time. I mean, the best designers I know are guys who read a lot and they watch a lot of movies and they travel as much as they can. And their passion encompasses everything from military history to politics to art to, you know, I mean, the better the input, the better the output is the best way I can say it. And the best designers are guys who and girls, you know, who can turn on a dime, who can come up with ideas in a void. Who can take something that's broken and fix it immediately, who can offer solutions where no one else has a solution to offer, right? So, and that is not something that you can get in a specific college course. When people say, what game design school should I go to? I'm like, don't go to a game design school. Go to a liberal arts college. Take as many courses as you can and everything from, like, you know, sculpture to...
And then drop out.
Computer graphics, and then drop out. you know, get a degree and then, you know... And be useful, you know, be one of those people who, you know, I think you guys were saying on a previous podcast, you know, get into the industry how you can, show people how useful you are. But good designers will always kind of make themselves known because they're there, you know, with a solution in hand or they're able to take something and turn around and make it good. You know, I love these design shows on TV. Like, you know, I'm not into fashion, but I love Project Runway or Top Chef because what you're seeing is basically what design is, right? Like, here's a bunch of corn husks, make a dress. And a good designer will make a dress, not just a functional dress, but a kick-ass dress out of whatever they have because they have all of this inspiration, all of this knowledge, all of these sources to work with in their head. So I'm not sure if that's like an easy answer, but I think that that's, you know, level designers especially too need to focus on things like architecture and that sort of thing. The other thing, I'm writing an article now about writing a book, which is kind of funny. It's making me address a lot of this stuff. But
and ironically, we're filming a documentary about Ed writing his article about writing that book.
Right. And then I had a dream about it. you know, I'm thinking about a lot of this again. And, you know, there are specifics based on what kind of, you know, design is fracturing. Like any good entertainment industry, you know, it used to be film was just a dude with a camera. And then maybe another dude who stood around, I don't know, told actors what to do. And then eventually the dude who stood around split up into two dudes. You know, one guy to tell people what to do and the dude to help him get coffee, I guess, right? Games are like that. And what used to be a game designer turned into level designers and system designers and tech designers. And now level designers are splitting into like level scripters and level lighters and encounter experts and that sort of thing. So you do need to focus a little bit based on where you want to go in design. It's not just like there are game designers and you'll do everything anymore. That used to be the way when, you know, Richard Garriott was sitting at home, you know, making his games and put them in Ziploc bags or whatever.
And now he flies into space.
He does, yeah, and has a wicked castle where he throws Halloween parties.
Be honest, are you ever going to launch yourself into space?
I don't know. You know, I always wanted a Viking funeral. I don't think it's legal to sail dead people down rivers on fire anymore, so my only option might be to just, you know, launch myself into space in a fiery rocket.
That'd be sweet.
We'll see. Yeah. It might get expensive, but if I start saving now, maybe. But anyway, yeah, design is all about curiosity, and it's about like just knowing lots of things that seem really trivial and to the point where it becomes essential to have that knowledge, and all of a sudden you'll be a superstar and everyone will love you.
And are there any common threads that you've noticed in any of the games that you make or play that you think are recurring that come up a lot?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, what's funny is, you know, all games, like all stories, tend to come from, like, you know, like a handful of basic archetypes, you know? And I did Splinter Cell early on. That was the first game I ever released. And that was really, you know, we just took Thief and we gave it, like, a kind of a more modern persona.
Spoilers.
Oh, yeah, sorry. Then I went and I did Harry Potter games. And when I came to Zipper, a lot of the guys I interviewed with were like, why did you make Harry Potter games? And I was like, I was tired of making third-person shooters. You know, I decided I'm going to make a game where, heck, actually my child could play it. You know, I went home and I basically took the editor and made tons of Harry Potter rooms for my kid. I think it was 4 at the time. Just filled rooms full of jelly beans and he had a great time. I just sort of needed that, right, in my career at that point. But the funny thing is, you know, you can take all sorts of stuff from Harry Potter. Not obviously wands, you know. Like, there's very little magic in SOCOM 4 other than the magic of SOCOM. TM. But, you know, experiences in games like Harry Potter, setting up boss battles, architecture, the flow of the environments, the pacing.
Even explaining things to the player is a good one, because trying to get people to learn something without beating them over the head with it and treat them like they're smart, too, is not easy at all.
Yeah, exactly. You know, even that sort of what we call stealth learning, right, where you... This is something that Miyamoto is sort of renowned for, is, you know, the slow introduction of mechanics, or showing the player things that they will be able to do later in the game, but aren't able to do now, but doing it in a way that isn't really all that frustrating. You know, even things like what we call gamer logic, which is the ability to speak in sort of subtle ways that the player understands, right? So a case of gamer logic is, oh, wow, a locker full of ammunition. I guess there's a big battle coming up, right? You know, that's not something that we necessarily do to be obvious, but the player begins to read those cues subliminally, and we don't have to have a big honking text box that says, better load up, there's a big boss battle coming, because people hate that. So, so something like Harry Potter, Splinter Cell, those things have all played a really big educational role in terms of what good design is, what players respond to, that sort of thing. And of course, you know, you carry that on for as long as you're in the industry.
I think so that before the universe explodes, we should probably get to some Q&A here. Jeremy's making a face. Let's get to some SOCOM questions first. DevilDog66 wants to know, is SOCOM 4 single-player gameplay only set in Southeast Asia, or will we see other locations as well?
It's only in Southeast Asia, and we made that decision not lightly. For CA and FTB2, we set both those games in a mythical country of our own devising, simply because we wanted to have one plot line and not divide the story up into four discrete chapters and have four bad guys and that sort of thing. Because it's really hard to tell a story in three missions, right? It's a bad guy. You go in, you take him out, save America or whatever. You know, you're done. All right, do it again three more times. We don't have the ability to really pump up the villains or get to know the characters, that sort of thing. So we decided to do the same thing for SOCOM 4. The other thing that turned out is, on the PlayStation 3 or whatever your next-gen console of choice is, it's really expensive to make things. And so when we looked at it, we were like, well, we could do, you know, an Arctic environment or a desert environment, but then we're tripling the amount of assets that we need. And it, you know, to make a house, just a simple house in Southeast Asia, takes a lot more time than it did in the PS2. It takes more artists, more time. So it was also kind of an economic reason to have one location. So it will be Southeast Asia in SOCOM 4 for the entirety of the game. But we have managed to pick a lot of really diverse locations. So we've got urban areas and big cities and small towns and mountain areas. So even though it's only in one location, you should see a ton of diversity in the terrain.
So SOCOM wants to know, what are you guys trying to accomplish with the storyline? What feelings are you trying to invoke in players, and what were the key factors surrounding the decisions behind the location and the setting of the game outside of the technical?
Well, you know, any storyline is trying to make people want to know how it ends, right? So I think SOCOM games have always been really cool at sort of authenticity and giving the player that visceral feeling of, like, you know, you are a Navy SEAL, or this is the sort of thing you could expect that the SEALs would do. On top of that, we wanted to layer for SOCOM 4 a sense of, well, what's going to happen next? How are my actions? How are the things that I'm doing part of a bigger picture? You know, if I blow up, you know, this area, or if I protect this dam, or if I, you know, stop these bombs from being destroyed, I want to see the impact of that. And I want to know that that's one step along the way towards a resolution. And that resolution is going to be a big resolution between me and this bad guy or whatever. So the storyline was really just to kind of kick us into, you know, the next-gen console territory a little bit, looking at our peers and seeing what they're doing with great storytelling. It's also just another reason for people to want to not stop playing S4, right? Like, you know, on one hand, I'm having fun. The game is cool. I want to get back in the action. On the other hand, I want to see what happens to these people. You know, these guys are trapped behind enemy lines. There's no indication of, you know, who's going to live, who's going to die. That's a good story. It's just I want to know what's going to happen.
S-Vio, possibly Sony Vio, ding, money to Sony, wants to know if, he says, what is more important to you for SOCOM 4, the single player or the multiplayer? And he says, don't give us a we try to get the best results for both experiences answer.
He took your answer.
Does not compute. Wow.
I would assume, as creative director, you personally, you'd be more inclined to be on the single-player bandwagon, yeah?
You know, my personal preference is single-player games. I used to like competitive multiplayer, but I'm old now. I got kids, and I don't have...
You're tired of them beating you?
I'm tired of them beating me. There's a funny Penny Arcade about this. And I just don't have the time that you need to invest in being good at multiplayer. I mean, you know, it's like you really have to practice. It's like being a virtuoso. It's like playing the violin, the deadly, deadly violin. But my personal preference is co-op and single player. So that's what I like to play. But if you're a good designer, and which I aspire to be one day, you know, you got to know who your audience is, right? And then multiplayer is a huge component. In fact, it's so huge that there are people who only play multiplayer. So, you know, what's more important for SOCOM 4? To try not to say in exactly the same words that SVIO used. I mean, it has to be, you know, a complete package, because there are people who obviously want a single-player experience. And single-player, at best, is an awesome experience. At worst, is a way to practice for multiplayer, right? And so, I mean, that's the other thing, too, is a lot of people need a single-player experience to build up the skills and, you know, the guts, perhaps, to go online and fight with people who've been playing this game for a long time. Co-op, I think, is really useful because that just it's as an emerging form of multiplayer, I think the experiences you get in co-op are very different from both multiplayer, competitive multiplayer, and single player. And of course, multiplayer is like the tail of the game. You know, a good multiplayer mode, which SOCOM has had, you know, since your dot, gives the game a tail and a reason to play long after you probably even forgotten about the single player story. So personal preference is co-op and single player for me. But my preference has no bearing on the game, because a lot of the guys on the team have been making SOCOM for years and years and years. You know, we have an entire team of people who live and breathe multiplayer, and they are, I trust, because I see them working on this every day, making a superb multiplayer experience for SOCOM 4. So it's the whole enchilada.
Chief Wiggum wants to know, what do you view as the game feature design elements that are critical for Zipper to nail on day one specifically, in order to preserve what makes the SOCOM experience a SOCOM game?
Controls.
I'm sorry you did not phrase your answer in the form of a question.
What are controls?
Thank you.
What are good controls? Good controls. Gotta have a good control scheme. You have to allow people to jump in and play the game right away without, you know, suffering or having to relearn everything. You know, that's the biggest turnoff, I think, is like, wait a minute, they moved all these buttons, you know, to places I don't expect. There's no one universal controller setup, but, you know, as games move forward, there are certain expectations that FPS and TPS players have. So
so why not offer customizable controls? Because that question comes up a lot, too. If aren't the ultimate controls the ones that you allow the users to select themselves?
This is going to seem cheesy, but when you offer customizable controls, you're also giving the developer an out in terms of saying you don't have to make your core controls very good. You know, I love custom controls for complex games like flight simulators or whatever, or, you know, like strategy games where there's a lot of hotkeys potentially, or, you know, I've got like all sorts of different functions and there's no preset way, right? But on the other hand, most people are going to come in on a dual stick system with four face buttons and, you know, two sets of triggers. There's expectations for the majority of players about how those controls will be mapped. There's a subset of players who obviously have very weird sort of specific controls. And as much as I'd like to, you know, to make things easier for them, we kind of have to aim at the mass, we have to aim at the glut of players and go for the highest level of expectation. And so we could do customized controls or have everything be, you know, open. There's a couple things that fall out of that. A, we need a UI. We need a way for you to quickly and easily map all the functions to the buttons and the more we have, the more complex that system gets, and then all of a sudden we're cutting features from the game to support this crazy, like, you know, control configurator. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of hard-coded expectations on the engine side that, you know, this button does this. That was just an option.
And there's also QA implications.
QA implications, yeah. But primarily my first response is a lot of games that have customizable controls, not all of them for sure, but a lot of them tend to not focus on making the controls really good, because they're, well, if the player doesn't like it, it could just change around. Whereas what we're trying to do is we're trying to do a lot of play tests and say, these are the best controls that we can make for this game.
Let's get to some mag questions here. The first one comes from HDK, who has a very good question, because Walmart has put up two things recently. They just the other day put up a thing for the Ico and Shadow of the Colossus collection, mm-hmm. which came true.
Yes.
However, prior to that, they also put up a thing for Mag 2. What is the situation with Mag 2?
This is the first time that we've actually addressed this question.
Yeah.
Even though it's been all over the forums. We've been waiting for you to talk about it.
Oh, man.
We like putting you in the spot.
Yeah. Well, we sent out our strike teams to illuminate all those responsible. They should be reporting back in soon. That's how we do things at Zipper, you know. No, that was, I believe, a misunderstanding about what the product was. And I think fundamentally there was an expectation. Maybe Walmart jumped the gun a little bit in terms of taking... Did they take pre-orders?
Well, as everybody knows now, this week we've announced Mag 2.0.
Yes,
and part of Mag 2.0 is PlayStation Move support, and because of that, a lot of the new Mag packaging will likely have some kind of Move
like a
sticker or some kind of inclusion there. And because of that, our own personal theory is that they received those units in early. Knew that we were calling it Mag 2.0 internally as part of the download, and misinterpreted that as a Mag 2.
That was a much more altruistic reason than I was about to give.
Okay, hit us with yours.
Greed.
That's always a good one.
Yeah. No, Mag 2.0 is super cool. There's tons of stuff going in there, things that we wanted even before Mag even shipped. Things that we've been sitting on that we knew would make the game really well, but it's not a new product. You don't have to repurchase another version of Mag if you already got it. So I think nice of Walmart to be very enthusiastic about our product, but
don't be surprised if it disappears.
Yes, I think it will be disappearing
because it doesn't
soon.
Exist.
Yeah, it would be tough to pay for something that doesn't exist. But if Walmart can do that, then
I just remember some of our initial reactions when we saw that. Like, are we working on Mag? Are we working on this?
Yeah.
We better get started.
The funny thing is I knew that we weren't, and yet even I questioned myself when I saw the email. I'm like, did I forget something?
I sent Scott Rudy an email saying, well, you've got a couple months. You better get going on this.
It's a couple of months, yeah. Just make a new game.
Yeah.
How hard is it, right?
Pretty quick.
We have machines for that now.
Guntang says that many have claimed that the Shadow War is dead, while others... And I assume that Guntang is among these others, based on how he phrases this question, do not believe that the Shadow War is dead, and think that it could be expanded dramatically with the use of maps or contract revamps. What is your feeling on the current state of the Shadow War, and are you guys shying away from the Shadow War and its implications, the chase after simpler solutions for Mag's evolution? What's the deal?
I'll be honest, I think the Shadow War shipped already as a simplified version of what we'd anticipated it would be. Mm-hmm. I mean, early on, the Shadow War was something that was meant to be a big driving factor for people to want to play Mag. It was really heartening to see so many people get behind the factions, but what we wanted to do is make sure that, once you'd picked a faction, you'd be, on playing a lot to make sure that your faction was on top and that, the contracts that you would win would be obviously beneficial. But of course, with that comes a lot of responsibility and balancing. And I think what we had to do is simplify some things and make sure that the contracts weren't overpowering, right? But then if the contracts aren't overpowering, what's your incentive to, to play, for your side and to take that contract back? There's a lot of questions there. So what we did is we shipped Mag with, I think, a fairly compelling little system for the Shadow War that was a way to not only explain why the PMCs were fighting each other, but to show a dynamic world. As we move forward, I think that we realized that the Shadow War was a bit of a constraint to people's experience. The first thing I think we realized was, not having faction-neutral maps, having faction-owned maps, and this has been discussed before on the podcast, led to some people not really seeing a lot of the content. And when you buy a game and it's $60, you want to be able to play everything. You want to be able to see all that content. And so... that led us to down the hard decision of I think, removing some of that Shadow War aspect a little bit to support more faction-neutral maps, to get people to see, more of the content and to allow for a more efficient or a more ergonomic model for them to enjoy. That's not to say that the Shadow War is dead. The Shadow War is something that, is still a fictional component of Mag. We will not, remove the Shadow War. The factions are still vying for power. It's not an open war. It's not like, these huge battles are happening like on people's doorsteps. They're out where PR can cover and spin and try and make sure that there is no war. Because that's important to Mag for me, is that this isn't like a dystopia of like, bands of armies roaming, the land fighting each other. This is meant to be kind of like a secret you know, battle between PMCs in a more utopian environment. Gameplay ramifications, what's going to happen with Shadow War in terms of how it's going to affect gameplay and if it's going to be a component moving forward. I think that there will still be additions, but I think that whenever the Shadow War stops us from making progress on MAG, or making sure that people are able to enjoy MAG as fully as possible, the experience will win and the Shadow War will take a backseat.
Hey Zeus, is it possible that Interdiction could be revamped into a 3 PMC battle a la Escalation?
Anything is possible, hey Zeus. Yeah, it could. I mean, the 3 PMC maps, Escalation, I think, was kind of a way for us to deliver something that a lot of fans had, I think, had expected even before MAG shipped, right?
Yeah.
They saw 3 factions, and they're like, this is going to be badass. You know, all 3 factions will be in a map. Because RTSs have been doing that for a long time, you know, having 3 factions on the field. Once we were able to actually get that working, it was great. And actually, I think Ben and Jason last week mentioned this too. It allowed us to kind of purge our level designs a little bit and go for much simpler open maps, which I think work really well.
Mm-hmm.
So the one thing is, could we take other game modes and revamp them as 3 PMC maps? We could, but I think we'd have to do a lot of level design to support it. You know, we wouldn't just be able to, like, you know, suddenly make a current Interdiction map like 3 players.
Yeah, there's no switch flipping.
Yeah, so, but I think that hopefully, if the interest in Escalation is as much as we think it'll be, and if those maps continue to be popular, yeah, I think we'll take a look at those and see what we can do. But I think that the future of MAG is probably in more complex game types, like 3 faction versions of what we have, or maybe similar game types to things like Interdiction or Domination, but with a 3 faction spin.
Kagehoshi wants to know, if we were to get additional maps for existing game modes, can we expect different environmental styles from what we've seen, like snow or night maps? Night maps come up all the time. We had night maps pre-release, but I think you even talked about this the last time you were on, maybe, that you didn't like how they looked.
We have a much better lighting solution now, meaning that, you know, we have technology and tools to render lighting in a much more realistic, aesthetically pleasing manner. That we've been developing for SOCOM 4, that I really hope we can apply that to MAG, because night maps are cool. Snow maps are my favorite. I've been playing a lot of Minecraft recently, and I just realized that there's snow maps in there. And as soon as there was a snow map, I was set. Something about snow maps and gamers, it's like, you know, peanut butter and chocolate. But I think that snow is more difficult because it involves a lot of different physical aspects. I mean, we looked at snow for sure. Vehicles will have to handle differently. I mean, it depends. If it's just an aesthetic treatment, sure, just plonk a bunch of white textures everywhere and have some particle effects. But we didn't want to do that. We were like, you know, will we have snow vehicles, snow camoed weapons? Vehicles have to handle differently. There's slip. There's drift when you turn at speed. Does snow pile up? Every time there's an abutment or, you know, every time there's an overhang, snow can't fall through it. You know, it has to drift up, all that kind of stuff. So that was a little bit harder. Night maps, I think, are a much more realistic option in the future, at least more quickly to see those, maybe even night versions of the current maps. So we've talked about that a lot, and I think now that we've got the technology, it's much more feasible to do night maps. The only thing is some maps are not so great, because if you have like an outdoor map, like a lot of the Escalation maps, there aren't places where there'd be a lot of light.
Mm-hmm.
So you'd have to do the kind of Hollywood night thing. So night maps tend to work better in urban environments where there's lots of
street lights and
artificial light sources, right? Because otherwise then you need to introduce things like night vision goggles and ways to compensate for players not being able to see each other. And that can get a little hokey. And there's one thing I just don't want to do is devolve into another game where you play the entire thing in sort of in shades of green. I think we're past that now. So
our last question of the week comes from
my favorite question.
Red Violence. And this is a big one. This is a big one.
Especially for Ed and I, because we talk about this quite often.
He wants to know, Ed, how is that zombie game coming along?
In my head, it's done. And it's awesome. You know, maybe zombies are getting a little played out, but I there's something about zombies, and there's something about a zombie tactical shooter. I mean, you know, Left 4 Dead is doing this a little bit more. There's definitely games I know that are coming out that may not even have been announced yet that, you know, that friends are working on or whatever. That
there's the Housemarque game, which I can't recall off the top of my head now, but the Super Stardust guys are making that zombie shooter.
Yeah, kind of more action-paced, but, you know, I'm thinking, like, you make a tactical shooter with zombies, and all of a sudden the rules change, right? It's all about ammo conservation. If anyone out there has ever played The Thing, the game, really good game by guys who'd never made a game before, as far as I know, there was things like fear management and trust management. It was a squad-based shooter, but like, you know, if you know, you could order guys to do things at gunpoint, but then they wouldn't trust you. I mean, there's so many amazing components that would just elevate tactical shooters to new heights with the inclusion of zombies or some kind of survival horror element. But we're working on it. I think, you know, slowly but surely, Jeremy and I and other people at Zipper are chipping away.
May take 20 years, though.
Yeah, it may take 20 years. I may just have to make it in my spare time, you know, in which case it'll never get done. But, yeah, you know, the thing is, someone will make it, and I'll be like, I wish I could have made that game, but then I'll enjoy it. So that's the main thing. As long as someone makes a zombie tactical shooter that really does it right, then I'll be a happy man.
Zombies will never be played out. I mean, they'll have their ebb and flow of hotness, you know, in terms of their general appeal, but I think that there's something inherent about zombies as an enemy, outside of the technical benefits of having zombies as an enemy, but they're always scary because they take something that's already scary
and they
want to
eat your brain.
Yeah, I mean, and they take something that's already scary, death,
yeah,
and they make it scarier.
Well, you know, it does two things, right? Like, the zombies are both an enemy and an environmental hazard. So, you know, you take a mall, which is seemingly innocuous, you fill it with zombies, and it's, oh my god, I mean, it's like it's completely and utterly changed, right? Now you're scanning to see where is the concentration of zombies and where are they moving and where can I hide. You know, you look at environments completely differently when they're filled with zombies. The second is, as everyone who knows zombie movies or who are big zombie fans, you know, zombie fiction is all about the interaction between the survivors, right? You know, the zombies are just there. And the true horror is, like, you know, the relationships and the things that people have to do to survive. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's pretty compelling. So those things, I think, are pretty classic themes. And, you know, maybe it won't be zombies soon. Maybe it'll be, you know, I don't know, giant crabs or whatever the next big
sparkling
thing.
Sparkling vampires.
Sparkling vampires. I have a friend who's an author. She's all famous now. And she wrote the Spiderwick Chronicles. And she's written a lot of, like, books about sort of fairies existing amongst us and freebasing fairy dust and stuff. It's pretty cool stuff. And she's watching the trends, you know, and the whole supernatural love stories. You know, it is vampires now, but the trends are already, you know, kind of pointing towards angels. That's the new vampires, would be like, mm-hmm. you know, insipid stories about high school girls falling in love with angels.
Nicolas Cage and Meg Ryan did this 10 years ago.
They made an insipid remake of a great Wim Wenders movie. So if you're going to watch the Meg Ryan movie, don't watch the Wim Wenders original. It's about 3 hours longer.
Well, you also have fairies in True Blood now with the Fae and all that stuff.
That's true. Yeah. But she's saying that she's got early indications that steampunk is going to be the next kind of mainstream sort of supernatural fiction thing, and a steampunk zombie survival horror tactical shooter may be the best game ever made.
/ puzzler.
Yeah. That, I think, brings us to the Zip Tip.
For those of you that aren't familiar with the Zip Tip, who are you? Because I've explained it every week now for 21 weeks.
All the new listeners.
But if this is your first episode, the Zip Tip is basically whatever words of wisdom that our guest, in this case it's Ed, would like to impart unto you, our listeners. Could be anything. Could be about the game that we've made or that we are making, or it could be about life itself. Ed, you going to break the streak of folks who come in and don't have a Zip Tip with them when we ask, or do you not know?
Oh, a tip. You know, my gaming tip would be, if you haven't played Valkyria Chronicles, go out and play it. It's like my favorite game ever. I don't know. I love that game. And I really don't enjoy Japanese games all that much, but there's something about that game. It's the military kind of vibe. It's the cool, like, turn-based stuff.
Great art style.
Yeah, amazing art style. I'm playing on the PSP right now, and I'm feeling a little bit gypped because the art simply isn't anywhere near as good as it is on the PS3. But there's my tip. If you haven't played it yet, go play it. You'll probably find a copy for cheap. Let's see, specific tips? I don't know. I think, you know, I have S4 tips, but we should probably wait for the game to be done and out.
Yeah.
You know, like, oh, watch out, that guy on level 2.
great, now we know there's a level 2.
There's a guy in level 2.
Yeah, I know, I'm sorry. Mm.
Double spoilers.
And then I already gave a design tip, so that's like 3 tips in one show.
Get the try tip.
That's pretty good.
Yeah. Can I say something? Actually, here's a tip. This is something I always mean to say in the show or just talk to people, you know? Got a lot of people out there who are like, you know, make SOCOM 2 HD. We know those guys. I mean, they have a passion for playing that, right? A lot of people with really good ideas. You know, we read them on the forum. They write questions into the show. Like, you know, just because we don't do it doesn't mean it's not a great idea, mm-hmm. right? But when I started in this business, I was like a graphic artist. This is like 11, 12 years ago, right? You know, and I didn't have any experience whatsoever. And I went on to make, you know, Splinter Cell. Splinter Cell was there was four of us, and it was our idea. And basically it stemmed from the brain of, you know, a lot of people worked on the game, but the, you know, the original concept and the things that drove that game was a small group of guys together in New York who worked well together, right? So here's my tip. If you've got really good ideas, you're playing SOCOM, and you think you can do a better job, go out and do it. Really. I mean, there's so many good tools. You can go out and get Unity. It's an engine that works on almost all platform. There's 3D Buzz. There's tutorials for modeling. There's any piece of software you need to make a game, there's a free version of it. I guarantee it. Go be the next us. Be the next developers. You know, like you can sit back there and complain the Zipper isn't doing what you think that they should do. And, you know, you're probably right. I mean, this, you know, sometimes we're not going to do what you think we should do for good reasons, of course. But, you know, you may also be the next design genius, you know. Get together with your friends. If you've got a clan, start making a game, and you guys may be the next Zipper. So that's
just
my tip.
Just don't be obvious in your company name. If you do this, don't become like Buttonfly Interactive or something.
Yeah. Yeah. Rep is.
There you go. Zipper 2.
Yeah. So that's
that
my
I
tip.
Think, that, I think, brings us to the end of the show. Ed, thank you for joining us again.
No problem.
Great having you here talking about design in general, which is great general, when we can't talk about any SOCOM 4 information.
Yeah,
so.
Sorry, no big revelations this week, guys.
Yeah. Well, we found out that we're not making Mag 2 at the moment. So,
and we found out
revelation.
That SOCOM has a level 2 with a guy in it.
That's right.
That's a big one. Right.
Note to self, cut guy.
If you want to submit your questions or comments to Zipline, you have a couple ways to do it. You can use the official threads that we put on the Mag and SOCOM forums at forums.mag.com and forums.socom.com. Or you can send us an email to zipline@zipperint.com. We do read every single thing that is sent to us and on the forums. Takes us a while, but we read them all. So if you want to ask your question, especially for that October 1st episode with Mike, make sure that you send them in so we can check them out.
You can also find us on social networks such as Twitter and Facebook. If you go to twitter.com/zipper or facebook.com/zipperinteractive or /SOCOM, you can find things that we're putting on there. That's
right.
Us.
Yeah, Chris and I update it all the time for you, Ed.
I love that. Yeah, I love the Facebook.
We
site.
Say, "Hey, Ed, here's the latest
hey,
episode.
Hey, Ed, check
of the show.
This out."
Yeah,
yeah. And I pull a lever, and it loads it on my machine.
So, remember, after this episode, we go biweekly. So, October 1st, Mike Gutman, Vice President. He makes a lot of very important decisions here. So make sure you have lots of very important questions for him. Ed, once again, thank you very much for joining us. Chris, thanks for being there.
Just launch ya.
Right. And till next time, what Ed said.